Welcome to Inside Ivy Hoops. This is Mike Tony, editor of Ivy Hoops Online, prepared to try to make sense of the Penn Princeton Palooza we find ourselves in and an awful lot of other goings on and throughout the league. Fresh off a PP doubleheader that yielded thrillers on both the women's and men's games at Jadwin Gym last Saturday, with a men's rematch at the Palestra looming this Saturday. A lot to get to around the league, and we will, but why not start the podcast by pulling on the many threads that Penn Princeton gave us last weekend and look ahead to that critical rematch? Here to help with that, once again, is IHO's own George Clark. How are you, George?
I'm fine, thanks. It's nice to be with you again, Mike.
Yes. Yeah, how many podcasts have you been on for us over the years?
That's a dozen.
Yeah.
At this point, I would think.
Oh yeah, I think more than that over the last. This is the fifth
time
season.
Time goes by very quickly.
It does, yeah. But can't have you on enough. Let's go in chronological order, and start with the women's tilt, a 66-60 victory for Penn at Jadwin Gym that truly was a game of quarters. Princeton dominated in the third quarter, but Penn turned the tables in the last stanza, scoring 27 points in the final 10 minutes to avoid dropping four straight to the defending Ivy League champion, which had held Penn to 34 points total in last season's Ivy Tournament final. Your thoughts on this game, George?
Well, it was kind of a splash of cold water in Courtney Banghart's face, quite frankly. I was surprised at how well Penn played in that last quarter. They did that at home before one of the larger crowds at Jadwin in many years. Was very impressive. They thoroughly outplayed Princeton and got a deserved win. That Phoebe Sturba was very, very impressive.
She sure was. And, you know, Penn's defense, I touched on it briefly last week on the podcast, is obviously one of the nation's best. It was already statistically the Ivy's best last season, but it seems to have tightened up even more, obviously in a good way this year. Carly Littlefield and Gabrielle Rush did combine for six trays, but you know they had more open looks that they just didn't hit. It was kind of a lot of lost opportunities, as you're going to have in a close game. It has to cut one way, and Bella Allery left 6 points at the free throw line, despite an otherwise dominant performance. And Penn came out hot from deep, and that really set the tone that this was not going to be another easy Princeton win. I don't think there was anything flukish about Penn's win. Phoebe Sturba can do that to you, and of course Saleha Parker, last year's Ivy and Big Five Rookie of the Year, was an imposing defensive presence. Princess Aguirre notched 12 points all in the first half and a dozen rebounds too. It was an ensemble performance. Does this game change how you think about Penn's team?
Not really. I've always been impressed by the job they do over there. For the last several years, as you know, Mike, I think it's been for the last 9 years, they've either Penn or Princeton has represented the NCAA in the tournament, and in 1 year they both did. So Penn has never surprised, have a great recruiting pipeline. They're extremely, the coaching staff has been together for a while, and they get good players, and they show them how to play, and they execute game plans. And in the fourth quarter, it seemed like they made every big shot, every big free throw. Every time Princeton fought back, and they certainly did, they were in the game in the last half minute, Penn had an answer. Boy, that's not blukish. That'll show up. I think these two teams are going to have to beat each other. Somebody's going to have to beat the other team twice to advance.
Right, exactly right. And it has been remarkable to see the rise of Mike McLaughlin's program. They had to get on the same level as Princeton with Courtney Banghart coming on the scene there first, and they have, and it's become a two-team tussle atop the league that is very fun to watch, no matter which side or you're on, whether you're on one of those sides. I don't think the rivalry has ever been more intense, looking back over the histories of the two programs, than it is now. I should note that Penn has a big five matchup. Of course, they're all big in the Big Five, but an extra big one coming up against Villanova next week. And of course, Penn was able to knock off Nova a season ago, and you know, it's checking off the benchmarks as time goes on. There's an awful lot with this Penn program, and it's been cool to see. We'll see how it plays out, but even from the start of this season, Penn didn't get totally flattened at Notre Dame, lost only by 20. I thought that was encouraging from the beginning, and you know, we'll see how things go. Well,
that's very true. Notre Dame, of course, they're in a huge televised matchup tonight. It should be a lot of fun to watch. But right. The interest in the women's program, for instance, has really climbed over the years. There was a huge crowd we had when this weekend for the first game, as well as the second game, and I believe just looking at the way the stands emptied out, a lot of fans came to see the women's game and didn't wait around to see the men's game. A lot of people did. There was a huge crowd. But it's just fascinating to see how much fan interest there is in women's basketball in the Ivy League, and certainly with Penn.
Well, I don't want to say it's ever a good thing when you leave before one of the genders play, but it is. I am glad that there are folks out there that follow the women first and foremost, and I know there are many beyond just parents and folks that have a natural vested interest in the program. So seeing that enthusiasm level out. Continue to level out between the genders is, it's encouraging, and certainly as it should be given the strength of the women's side league wide. Let's move on to the men's matchup, which took extra time to decide, a 68-65 overtime victory for the Tigers that really was as thrilling as it was sloppy. The P's combined to miss 34 three-pointers, 44% of their foul shots, and score a combined 9 points in overtime, just three from Penn. Back-and-forth affair. Penn came back from an 8-point deficit with 4.5 minutes to play after having led by 9 midway through the first half. George, you picked the Tigers to beat Penn, and they did. But were you surprised by any of the storylines that emerged from how they did it?
A lot of surprising things in that game. And sitting there watching it live was one of the more frustrating experiences I've had in a long time, because it seemed like Princeton was doing everything they could to lose the game. And Penn, unfortunately, had a lot of mistakes as well. Free throw shooting has been a particular problem for Penn lately, and it's certainly a huge contributing factor in the Tigers being able to pull it out in overtime. But what was most surprising, I think, was I won't say it's surprising, but it was surprising in the sense that Princeton was able to hang on with very little production from Devin Kennedy, Jalen Llewellyn. Kennedy did not make a three, and it's obvious that they were going to play him as tough as possible right from the start. Jalen Llewellyn was not much of a factor on offense. The biggest factor on offense for Princeton, of course, was Rosa, who was quickly becoming the big story. He was Ivy League Player of the Week, as you know, and certainly held his own against A.J. Brodeur.
Yeah. And what was striking to me was, you know, for much of this season, there wasn't discernible improvement, it seemed, in Princeton's defense from what it was last season. In fact, we talked about this just last week. How is Princeton's defense different this season from what it was last season? But against Penn on Saturday, the physicality and tenacity of Princeton's defense was something. It was pretty striking. And it was much different from what it was last season versus Penn at Jadwin. As you noted in your recap, George, Arira Guzzo made A.J. Brodeur work for everything he got down low. Miles Stevens played with a lot of swagger, but also very smartly on the defensive end with a good foul on Brodeur late in the game that, you know, prompted a, you know, yet another unsuccessful trip to the line for Penn rather than an easy layup or an and one for him. And that's how you win games when Devin Kennedy and when Jalen Llewellyn are having an off night. You rely on your defense. You get scoring contributions from depth players. Princeton couldn't do much of either in Ivy play last season, and it didn't get away with it. This year, the Tigers look like they can tick off those boxes, and that could make all the difference.
Well, I'm not sure how it happened. Of course, they had to play at Arizona State without Miles Stevens, which was a very difficult problem to have to overcome out there. We knew that those sophomores, Sebastian Much and Jerome DeRozier, were going to get a lot of minutes. We knew that they were going to have to produce. There's just no question about it. If they didn't produce, we weren't going to win. And the fascinating thing is that they both played in the last couple of games well on defense. Princeton's going to have to be, because they can stop people, get stops, and they're able to do that. They held Penn down and scoring, and DeRozier Much were both big factors. Of course, Stevens came back apparently without any ill effects. I mentioned in he sat for the first 3 minutes. The guy who started in his the turnover and Miles is in the game. I think he played 35 minutes or 38 minutes after that. So he apparently is okay physically, and if he is, he can go on to run and carry the team on back.
We've seen that before. Yes, from Penn's perspective, it's certainly not time to hit the panic button. Unfortunately, I don't think anyone is even thinking of reaching for it yet.
Well, oh, Lord, no. I've seen an early line that has some favorites at it by 4.5 to 5 or 4 to 5.5, somewhere in that range. And that seems to me to be a pretty accurate reflection of the way things are. The biggest difference I'm looking to this week, Michael Wang only played 16 minutes, and I don't think he played in the second half at all. If he did, it was only a couple of minutes. And he may very well have been in pain from that ankle injury. I'm not sure. Donahue didn't say anything after the game about that. But if he's able to play 20, 25 minutes at anywhere close to his efficiency from earlier in the season, they're going to be much, much tougher nut to crack on defense.
Yeah, Michael Wong didn't really seem to be himself coming off, as you said, that ankle injury from the Toledo Torpedo as that game went.
Rothschild didn't contribute a lot. He played about a minute, but he didn't appear to be himself either. And if both of those guys, I said it last week, if both of those guys were close to 90%, That's a much different ballgame. They weren't, so someone was able to hang on. Same thing goes this week. And I think at home, you're going to see them playing and playing well.
Yeah, I think Rothschild did have a greater impact, much greater impact on the game than Wong did. I think a lot of what Rothschild does sometimes doesn't. They're not exclamation point plays. They're certainly not stat sheet stuffing plays sometimes from him. But no, it wasn't. It was just one of those games where, you know, it's. That's sports. You know, I do think it's worrisome that Penn seems to be a lot more turnover prone this season. But I don't think that struggling to make open threes at Jadwin is something that Penn folks should be, you know, wringing their hands about. And there's some positives to take away, even from a sloppy game. Broder played really hard down low in Penn's second.
Broder is a load.
A load, yes.
Yeah. For Richmond to play him head-to-head and then end up as player of the week, that's a testament to Richmond. It certainly takes nothing away from Broder.
No, it was two great games.
I think one of Broder's problems is he played more than 40 minutes twice.
Right, exactly.
In 5 days.
Yes, that's a good
And he
point.
Was exhausted on Monday, and I really think he was wearing down at the end of that game Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, it is worth noting that this was Penn's second overtime game in a 5-day span after losing to Monmouth in overtime on New Year's Eve. That's, you know, two games that could have went either way, but they're both with extra periods that, you know, they're going to grind you down a little bit. Dev Goodman missed some open looks deep and at point-blank range. Of course, none bigger than his shot in the paint that rolled off the rim with 10 seconds left in overtime with Penn down one. You know, it just happens. I did like Goodman's aggressiveness and ability to slice Princeton's defense to the hoop. They got open looks despite Princeton's D clearly being locked in, and the defensive intensity was really impressive on both sides. But I agree.
Well, Devin Kennedy will in all likelihood end up as the 3-point career leader for Princeton for the season ends. Probably be the second leading scorer in history. Now, for him to not make a 3-point attempt, that's a tribute to Penn's defense.
Yeah.
I don't think that'll happen again.
No.
Pretty well.
Yeah, it was clearly top priority, as it should be. I mean, you know, if Arirogu Guzzo beat them, I don't think, you know, he's not necessarily going to be at the top of the game plan. But you know, when you've got good players and good role players, if that's the right label. You know, you're gonna beat even good defenses, and that's what Princeton was able to do.
He's shown some dimensions that Princeton centers have not shown. And Kareem, we had a guy named Kareem Maddox a few years ago. I don't know if you remember him.
Yes,
I think he's still playing professionally. Since he left, just now 9 years, we haven't had anybody who could. Things that Richmond and Rivergoza has been doing this year, especially with the ball.
Right. Yeah, that has been missing. That is a wrinkle that, you know, that's not how they've won games recently. That's a good point. But hey, I mean, you know, that's what you need, especially to offset as you made the comparison. You've got somebody that's beating you down low in A.J. Broder, where you think of a Chris Lewis or a Chris Knight as you get into league play. You know, it's nice to be able to return the favor.
Absolutely.
And win that sort of game, you know. But, yeah, absolutely. But I do, I do like, and I do agree with, I was going to say, I do agree with the ancient Quaker who wrote in his thoughtful Penn Princeton piece for the site this week that Penn does seem to be well positioned to, again, return the favor Saturday at the Palestra, where Penn will be wearing jerseys throwing back to the 1979 Penn team that went to the Final Four. A lot of Twitter buzz today about those uniforms. Penn folks like the old Pennsylvania emblazoned across the jerseys.
There was a great piece yesterday on the Penn Athletics website about that team. It was really well written and it brought some memories to me. I didn't obviously follow that team as close as I follow my own, but I certainly remember that year and that stretch tournament. I was an Ivy League fan in that tournament, and boy, Penn was just great.
Yeah, a run to remember. What's your prediction for Saturday's game, George?
Well, I think it's going to be another close game. I really do. These teams know each other. Both teams will make adjustments to what they did right, what they did wrong last weekend. I don't think you're going to see as sloppily played a game as we saw last week. That's a function, I'm sure, of the equipment on both sides as much as anything. They'll settle in. I think they'll both play well. I think Penn has an edge, 3 or 4 points. If it's a 3 or 4 point win for the Quakers, I won't be surprised. I'll be disappointed. I don't think it's going to settle anything. These teams are going to play each other again.
Yeah, I concur with all of that. You would think the Penn has at least a slight edge to hold serve on their end, I suppose. To even it up, I do think that the gap has closed between the two from what it was last season. I think that much is obvious. But yeah, I like Penn in another classic battle of the peas, and I agree that fortunately from a league perspective that these teams are going to meet, their paths are going to cross again. So looking at the league broadly, not a ton of action on really either side. This past week, the Ivy men were 3-0, though, in non-conference Division I play. Two overtime wins on the road for Yale at Cal State Northridge and Brown at Canisius, plus a win for Cornell at Towson, in which Matt Morgan tied his career single-game scoring high of 38 points, which he set in the season opener at Binghamton. Any game that Matt Morgan is in, Cornell can win. His impact on the game, and his efficiency. One of the most efficient scorers in the country and has been for some time now, a few years now. It's not just, he's not just getting these points by taking a ton of shots. He's effective with the basketball and not just, not just a counting stat eye popper.
You're very, very correct in that assessment. 19 years old. By the time they're 21 or 22, physically, they're a lot stronger. They're a lot better than they were as teenagers. And I think Morgan is playing at a level now that is a higher level than he's at before. And he's always been very, very difficult to contain. And interestingly enough, in his career, as the all-time scorer in the league.
Yes, behind only Bill Bradley, of course. But in Morgan-related news, more Morgan-related news, the midseason watch list for the Lou Henson Award was released this week. The Lou Henson Award, of course, presented annually to the nation's top mid-major player in Division I college basketball. Five Ivy players made the list. Morgan, Brown's Desmond Cambridge, Broder, Kennedy, and Yells Mieoni, all very deserving for sure. And the
That's
Ivy.
That's a heck of a first team.
Yeah. Yeah, really. Think
then,
about
and
that.
And they probably all won't make the first team.
Yeah, there's always to mix sports metaphors, there's always a curveball that gets thrown into the all Ivy mix, it seems, once league play comes around. More than one, really, more than one curveball. But for now, those are a very deserving slate of five. And the Ivy League was one of only three conferences to have at least five players on the list.
And that's certainly a testament to the upward trajectory of the league as a whole. And Brown, you mentioned Cambridge, Brown, with him on their team, I think there's a better cast of characters there in Providence than there is in Ithaca. Morton can beat anybody, but Cambridge and company can certainly beat anybody. I think they're going to be a big factor in the Ivy League race.
Yeah, I would agree with that. This is a year where the door is wide open to getting in to the tournament, I would say, and it's been, well, it's not happened yet for the Brown men, so this is the year to get in.
You know, Mike, it used to be everybody's worst trip was to get on to Princeton and Philadelphia back to back. That was a nightmare trip for everybody. And it probably will be this year, I hope. But going to Yale and Brown back to back, that's at least as much of a headache this year. I know for Princeton, for many, many years, we didn't worry too much about Brown. Didn't have to worry a lot about Yale until recently. But, boy, if you have to go there back-to-back, that's tough.
Yeah, that is going to be tough. That's two explosive offenses, never mind the improvement that – certainly the statistical improvement at this point that Brown has shown defensively as well. It's an intriguing tandem of travel partners there, to be sure. And, of course, they open up with a back-to-back against each other that's going to be it's going to be pretty telling, I would think, at least from an early season standpoint, where those two stand. Two more travel partners that are going to be scoring off a little earlier, though. Harvard and Dartmouth open their Ivy slates against each other at Leed Arena Saturday night. It's a game that KenPom gives Harvard a 2-3 chance of winning, but it could very well go the other way if the Big Green keep up the red-hot three-point shooting they displayed in non-conference play. Dartmouth made more than 39% of its threes in the non-conference, 20th in the nation, and well above the 33.6% that the Big Green shot in league play last season, which was good for just sixth in the conference. Harvard's defense, statistically the league's best per KenPom, though, and the Crimson did hold Dartmouth to less than 60 points in both their meetings last season. Dartmouth's sophomore forward, Chris Knight, really is an underrated player. He's in the conference's top five in scoring, rebounding, blocks. Brendan Berry, I think, is known league-wide. It's already been as well established that he's a potent three-point shooter, but he can do more than that, way more than that. He leads the league in assist-to-turnover ratio. Second in minutes played, too, behind only Devin Kennedy. In fact, he's the only player in the top six in minutes, interestingly enough, that doesn't play for Princeton or Penn. Harvard's got the worst turnover margin in the conference, worst assist-to-turnover ratio in the conference. But Dartmouth ranks next to last in Division I in defensive turnover percentage. Any read on either of these teams or thoughts on how this game might shake out, George?
Well, Dartmouth has played them tough up there in recent years. I don't remember last year exactly. They have had some good games against Dartmouth. They've had good games in Cambridge. So if Aiken and Towns are still out, if Dartmouth plays as well as they have played, they can certainly make a game of it. I don't think it's going to be a blowout. I think
Dartmouth may have a chance, may a close game, and they might have a chance at the end. You'd have to favor Harvard, of course, but I think Dartmouth has a chance. They expect to play well now. They had some success this year, so they expect to play well, and I think they will.
Yeah, I think it's going to be another good game. Of course, last year's matchup at Leed went to overtime. Harvard fortunate to walk away with the win in that one, and that was with
there you go. I have forgotten that one, but I know they played them tough up there.
Oh yes, and that was with Seth Towns. So you know, we'll see. Of course, obviously another year. Both teams different on each side, but it'll be interesting, and it should be. I do give Harvard the slight edge, but I would be surprised and disappointed if it cut really decisively one way or the other. On the women's side, precisely one non-conference game this past week, and that was an impressive Columbia win at Mercer that we're going to delve into here shortly. George, thank you so very much, as always, for coming on the program and enlightening me and the listeners. A lot of ground we covered there, and I'm very grateful. Thanks so much, as always.
Well, you're very welcome. It's always a pleasure, Mike, and we'll touch base.
Yep. Take care.